somebody left me a note about the difficulty of working with talk. That talk seems different from feel or image or touch. Different in the sense that, as the note says, I can get some degree of equanimity with touch, feel, image. But as soon as the talk arises, I am the talk. The identification is instant. It's very difficult to get any sense of, quote, distance. Indeed, it is true for most people, observing, quote, observing auditory thinking is extremely challenging initially. So, imagine that you trained monkeys to play the violin, okay? We would say it's not that they do it well, but that they do it at all. That's extraordinary. Did I convey the idiom? Okay. Okay. We don't expect them to play well. It's just amazing they can even do something like that. Okay. So, don't worry about noting talk well. Okay. It's not that you're going to be able to do it well. It's that you can even try to do it. That's extraordinary. Most human beings, most adult human beings, are logocentric. By that I mean they center their identity in talk space. That reflects itself in logorrhea. You don't know this word? It's the equivalent of diarrhea of the mouth. We do have this word, okay. So, for most people, talk is much more difficult than touch, feel, even image. But no one says you have to do it. If you want to explore it, do so. I will say it becomes easier with time, as time goes on. There's actually two things that are challenging about noting talk. The first is that we tend to immediately identify with it and say, it's me. The second is that the noting tends to be behind the event. Touch and feel, you can be right there. As soon as the touch arises, touch, feel. But talk, it's like 5 seconds later, or maybe 5 minutes later, you realize, oh, talk. So you're behind. Okay, so this is what everybody reports. It's hard to have some sort of distance or, quote, equanimity. And I'm always noting too late. But you're making a beginning, okay? It's an approximation. I can tell you, if you wish to note talk, that speaking the labels out loud is helpful. Because when you're mentally labeling, of course, it's a little confusing, right? Because the mental label is itself talk. Although eventually you're not confused by that anymore. But speaking the label out loud will help. I can also tell you that with time, you can note and penetrate the talk. What tends to happen is that at first there's a lot of surface talk. It's words, it's sentences. Then it tends to sort of become a little disconnected, not quite as continuous. There's like brief moments of quiet in between. And then it sort of gets quiet, but you realize that there's an undercurrent of something going on, subtle activity, which may be more or less continuous. So even though there's not words on the surface, there's some sort of rumbling in talk space, and it's more or less continuous. Well, you can just sort of soak your awareness into that. You don't need to get rid of that. And that, then the talk space gets more and more flowing. and just turns into a kind of vibration of energy, and you've penetrated talk. By the way, the same is true for image. At first, if you have images at all, it will be surface images. You see a person, you know what it is. But then you become aware that underneath the surface activity, there's a deeper, constant, sort of subtle visual thinking that you don't really know the content of. It's sort of like a whole lot of things at once being rapidly processed. But the way you know that it's image activity is it's in image space. It's in the place where you look all first images. Now you have this subterranean or deeper activity. What do? Nothing. Just observe it, let it happen. At some point, it becomes very fluid and is able to, you're able to visually think in a fluid way without needing it to be actual explicit images. The same is true in feel space.
It's more like a dream.
Because dreams reflect that subconscious image activity. Yes, and it can be dreamy, but you can be alert within that dreaminess, even have your eyes open and so forth. The same is true in feel space. Initially, when you sit and meditate, you probably don't get much feel because there's not much to stimulate. But then you start to notice that there may be feel. Certainly in daily life there is. But then you notice inside the so-called peace, there's a sort of undercurrent of subtle emotional stirring. It's comparable to the subtle talk and the subtle image. And it's a kind of flow in feel space. And then you just sort of let it do its thing. And so within the quiet, the blank, and the peace, there is this subtle level of activity that you unblock, and it unifies, and the whole subjective self, the whole self of thought and feeling, turns into an integrated sphere of sort of champagne bubbles. I know that sounds weird and hard to believe, but that's a progression that you may experience with time. But you have to start from the surface and go to the depths. Now, it is both a good thing and a bad thing that I describe this to you. Can you figure out why it's both a good thing and a bad thing? It's a bad thing because I'm setting you up for expectations. Well, it hasn't dissolved into flow yet. I haven't found any quiet yet, etc., etc. So I'm setting you up for expectations. That's bad. On the other hand, if I don't describe what can happen, you won't know what to look for. So it's sort of like it's lose-lose for the teachers. If we don't describe to you things that can happen, you won't be motivated. And you won't know what to look for. So that's not good. If we do describe it, then there's an expectation and a judgment because I haven't experienced that yet. And that's not good. So they say that to be a teacher guarantees you make bad karma. The only way to avoid bad karma is to not teach meditation. Because if you teach, you mislead. Absolutely. But we can only hope that we lead more than we mislead. So that in the balance, we make good karma.
That doesn't affect all teachers, does it?
Huh? As far as I know.
No, I mean, like other subjects.
Huh?
You might want to mention there's a big chart.
Yeah, there's a big chart that's out there that you can look at. What I would like to do is not take so many questions, folks. So during the talk, the Dharma talk, I would ask that let's not do questions. During the group process, you can bring that up because otherwise we'll never get anywhere. By the way, it's frustrating for me because Almost certainly, every question you want to ask, I have answered at least 100 times, and I have honed it to an art. So I would very much like to hear your questions, but I also, we need to do some practice and... say what? Yes, well, there'll be many more days to practice one way or another. So yeah, it's harder to work with talk. But just sort of, you can try. The other thing in this note was a mention that I have incessant tunes in Talkspace. Okay, there's like these songs and lyrics going, and it bothers me. Well, if you have songs and lyrics going, we'll consider that to be a kind of talk. So you could just note that as talk and treat it like anything else. If it bothers you, that means something else is going on besides talk, doesn't it? Some other sensory event is happening. What is that? Feel. You're annoyed by the talk, so there's a feel reaction to the presence of the tune and talk. You can, if you wish, pay attention to that annoyance as body sensation. In general, the reason that we have incessant tunes playing is that subtly they entertain us. That means there's usually some pleasant feel associated with it. You're smiling a little bit because it's like listening to regular music. So there's a pleasant feel associated with having the tune, but you might also have some judgment about it because it's intrusive, so there's an unpleasant feel. So there might be interest and anger at the same time in your body, two contrary flavors triggered by the tunes in your head. If you can detect those flavors and have equanimity with them, the tunes will tend to go away. Not that that's the goal, but I'll just point that out to you. When I first, like everyone else, I used to be annoyed a lot by these songs going in my head. And I would note it as talk, but that didn't seem to really do much good. Then it dawned on me, well, if I'm annoyed, there's an annoyance feel. And that might be easier to work with. And so I found it. I found the irritation that it caused in my body. It was pretty subtle, but I paid attention to it. And yeah, that was easier to work with. I could detect it. I could equanimize it. But the tunes didn't go away. But at least it was easier to deal with. Then a few years passed. Yeah, a few years passed. And then it dawned on me, you know what? When I'm doing these tunes, I've got a smile on my face. I'm entertaining myself. So then I focused on the pleasant feel that the tunes were causing. I brought equanimity to it. And then the tunes went away. So I just share that with you as something to know about working with talk. Now, I wanted to say a few words about how I conceive of sort of my purpose here, what my goal is in working with you. I'm presenting you with a rather complex formulation. And this is just the tip of the iceberg, okay? If you studied with me for a few years, there's a lot more, okay? It's a rather complex formulation. However, my goal is not to get you to do mindfulness with this particular system. I have no investment whatsoever that you use the techniques I teach you or use the vocabulary I teach you. My goal is to set you up to be able to have a lifetime of mindfulness practice. And the main way to do that, as I see it, is to understand what is the common thread in all forms of mindfulness practice. Because there are many, many ways of doing mindfulness. And a number of you have sampled those different ways. The two major traditions that come from Burma are the Uba Khin method that involves sweeping through the body. The only object is body sensation, either breath in this area here, which is, of course, body sensation, or broadly whatever is in the body, and you just sweep the awareness up and down. There's no noting, there's no labeling, there's no working with the thinking process or sights or sounds. It's all touch, feel in the body, and there's no distinction between touch and feel. It's just body, and you're just sweeping the awareness through. That's one of the major Burmese, modern Burmese traditions that is associated with Uba Khin, and famously taught by S.N. Goenka, although there are many other people that teach in that lineage that are not connected with his organization in Burma, for example. Okay, so that's one way to do Vipassana. Then there is the Mahasi Sayadaw lineage. Also goes back to 20th century Burma, but to a monk named Mahasi. Once again, famously taught by Upandita and his proteges. That involves noting. Now, and I've already mentioned that as far as I'm concerned, noting is not the same as labeling. Okay, noting is a certain process. Labeling, making a mental or spoken word, is an option on that process. People use the labeling in one of two ways, either to dismiss something in order to come back to something else, or to remind themselves to deeply and intensely experience the thing that they have labeled. So there's that whole Mahasi Sayadaw way of doing mindfulness. But there's much more in Southeast Asia than that. If you read Jack Kornfield's book, Living Buddhist Masters, you'll find 12 different ways to do Vipassana. Some of them taught by monks, some of them taught by householders, some of them taught by men, some of them taught by women, okay? But they're all different. So which is the right one? Well, the one that works for you is the right one. But what I would like you to see is that although the objects, the sensory objects that one works on differ, and the strategies for focusing differ, are not the same, okay, among these different ways of working, there are underlying commonalities, underlying things they have in common. If you focus on what they have in common, then you can participate in any of these traditions. What they have in common is, what do you think? Does every one of those approaches increase your base level of concentration? Yes. Okay. Does it increase your equanimity? Yes. Does it allow you to make finer sensory discriminations? Yes. From that point of view, they're all the same. The styles of the teachers differ. Their personalities differ. Some are sort of severe, okay? Some are sort of humorous, okay? Some are heartfelt. Some have psychic powers. Some emphasize conceptual clarity, like me, okay? That's sort of like what I'm into. Some say just keep it simple, you know, just sort of be there and smile and let things happen, okay? Like Thich Nhat Hanh, okay, for example. So the personalities differ, but once you realize that it's all fostering the same basic skill set, then it won't be confusing to you, and you can make use of any mindfulness teacher. That's what I would like, that you would feel comfortable in anybody's retreat, that you understand what's going on here and how to make use of it. There's some Vipassana teachers that only teach the breath, nothing but that. 40 years at the tip of your nose, okay, is what you're looking at. Is that a path to enlightenment? Absolutely. Meaning, it's not necessary to break things down into touch, sight, sound, feel, image, talk, relaxation, light, silence, peace, blank, quiet, okay? Don't need any of those things. Just focus. Just keep coming back to the tip of your nose. But you need to do that under the guidance of someone who knows how to use that to take you all the way to nirvana. Otherwise, without that guidance of the person that knows the different steps involved in that, it'll just be nothing more than a fairly simple concentration exercise. So it's not necessary to have the complexity that I give you. Then why do I give it to you? Well, because for a whole bunch of reasons that I won't go into. None of them, by the way, have anything to do with it's better. Okay? It's just my system is meant to be worked interactively in personal coaching, and I need a lot of detail to spot the windows of opportunity to give you one-on-one sessions. That's part of it. That's not all of it. So, what would happen if you decided that your path was going to be nothing but walking, the act of walking? This is going to be your path to enlightenment. So let's just take that as an example. Most people walk unconsciously. Well, in a sense, there's nothing wrong with that, but let's say that you decide you want to walk mindfully. So what would that mean? Well, a beginning of mindful would be that when your right foot moves, you know right. When your left foot moves, you know left has moved. Okay, so you know right, left, right, left. And just for simplicity's sake, let's say that it takes 1 second to step with the right and 1 second to step with the left. So now, every second, there's a moment of clear awareness. You know right, you can distinguish right stepping, foot stepping from left foot stepping, second by second. Now, I would like you to consider the colloquial meaning of the word real. Okay, real, R-E-A-L. Colloquial means in ordinary speech. Scientists and philosophers speak professionally about reality. But let's think about how the word real in English, I don't know if it's similar in Hebrew, but in English as the way ordinary people use the word real, colloquial, common usage, not in the sense of the philosopher or the scientist, but in the sense of ordinary conversation, I would suggest to you that the word real has two rather different meanings. One meaning is something is real to a person when it is sensorially vivid. The word real measures how sensorially vivid something is. For example, one week ago, what it's like to live in Israel was not very real for me. Clear. Yeah. Okay. 1 week ago, before I left the airport in New Jersey, I did not have a real sense of day-to-day life in Israel. I had some fantasy about what it might be like. Now, 1 week later, it's much more real. Real in the sense that it's vivid, that I have sensory information. Some of you have lived in India. Some of you haven't. Those of you who have lived, I have lived in India, okay? What daily life is like in India is real to the person that's lived there. If you haven't lived there, you just can't imagine, really. Those of you that have been there know what I'm talking about. So that's real in the sense of vivid or clear or sensorially rich. That's one meaning of the word real. In ordinary English, I emphasize, I'm not a philosopher, and if I'm a scientist, I'm an amateur at best. Scientists and philosophers, they deal with reality in a professional way. But the way the ordinary person talks about real is, something's real if it's vivid to me, it's alive to me, I experience it. Otherwise, it's sort of like a fantasy or an imagination. Now, there's another way, however, that the word real is used in ordinary speech. It is a measure of how gripping something is. If I find out that I have a serious disease, that's real, okay? It grabs me, it holds me, it rivets me. I can't go elsewhere. It fixates me. If I discover that my house has been robbed, okay, and my possessions are gone, that's real. Suddenly, that's just like everything, okay, for a while. So the word real can also measure how gripping something is, how all-encompassing and intrusive something is. This is a real problem. This is the real world. Okay, we have that expression, the real world. Well, the real world means the world that grips and holds you, that you can't let go of. That's a rather different meaning of the word real than real in the sense of sensorially rich. Follow what I'm saying so far? Not too abstract? Grasping, gripping. Maybe you can help supplement what I just said.
Which one?
The whole thing. Oh, you weren't listening. Oh, you got caught. You're busted. I don't blame you. It's logorrhea. Who's volunteering? Good.
Huh?
Okay. Why do I mention this? Seems sort of abstract and pointless and irrelevant. Let's go back to walking. So every second, you're aware, right, left, right, left. The act of walking has a certain reality in the sense that it's sensorially clear. Now let's say that we want to make it more clear. Well, we can be aware of the lift, the swing, and the place on the right, and the lift, swing, and place on the left. Now we're still walking at the same speed. So now, in each second, how many clear moments of awareness are there?
Six.
Well, actually, let's say that each step takes 1 second.
Three,
I would say. One, two, three. Yes, and then another three. One, two, three. Okay. But per second. And we're saying that each step takes 1 second. Okay? So one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. So when you started, every second you had one moment of clear awareness. You know, right versus left. Now we're making the act of walking a little clearer. Every second there's three clear awarenesses. Lift, swing, tread. Lift, swing, tread.
Left, left, and right.
Huh?
Left, left, and right.
Yes, right.
Left and right, because then if you label left to right, then you have your right, and left, and then you have left, so you make four.
No, you have to calculate per second, okay? Just for simplicity's sake, let's say that you are only paying attention to the lift, swing, and place, okay? Okay? So, one, two, three, per second. At the beginning, you were paying attention to right versus left. Okay, now you're just interested in lift, swing, place, lift, swing, place. So can we make it so it's now, in a sense, three times as real, walking, in the sense of sensorially rich. Now, how about, would it be possible to be aware of the beginning and middle and end of the lift? Yeah, you could do that. Beginning, middle, and end of the swing. Beginning, middle, and end of the placing. So now how many clear awarenesses are there per second?
Nine.
Okay.
Is it possible to do it that quick?
Yes, absolutely. So now you have, right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay. Moments of clear awareness. Now, it may not be possible to mentally label that quickly. That's another issue. Your mental label may just be lift, swing, place. But your awareness can detect the beginning, middle, and end of the lift. It's that fast. I could give you scientific evidence based on biological information theory and neuroscience that you can do that, okay? In fact, quite better than that. You could probably get about 50 moments of clear awareness per second. But anyway, so would you agree that if we're aware of, if we have 9 clear awarenesses per second, that is in some sense, loosely speaking, 9 times more real than just knowing left and right? Loosely speaking, we could. Those with a math background could argue, well, actually, it's not a linear function, blah, 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 but we won't go there, okay? Loosely speaking. Would it be possible at the very beginning of the lift that you could be aware of a couple tiny little fluctuations in muscle sensation? Okay, maybe 3 little distinctions at the beginning of the lift, okay? 3 little vibrations or changes in the middle, okay, at the end. Let's say that, it is possible to do that, okay? So now you have 27 distinct moments of awareness. Now, you can't possibly label that fast, but your nervous system is quite capable, if you have high concentration, your nervous system is quite capable of processing that quickly. As I say, according to the Encyclopedia of Science and Technology, it is estimated that we can consciously process about 50 distinct pieces of information per second. Okay? So let's say that 30 is the maximum. Okay? Now, we've got a sequence here. We start out with unconsciousness. Then we have 1 clear awareness per second. Then we have 3 clear awarenesses per second. Then we have 9 clear awarenesses per second. Then we have 27 clear awarenesses per second. From the perspective of clear awareness, or richness or detail or resolution. The experience of walking is becoming more and more real in the colloquial sense of real. But what's going on? Let's just look at something else. If I'm aware of the right in 1 second, and then the next second I have to be aware of the left, I can't hold on to the awareness on the right for more than a second, can I? If I hold on for more than a second on the right, I'm not going to be present on the left. If I have 3 clear awarenesses per second, okay, I can't hold on for more than a third of a second. If I have 9 clear awarenesses per second, I can't hold on for more than a ninth of a second. What's happening to the reality of walking in the sense of its gripping power? Its power to hold me, okay? It's becoming less and less real in that sense, okay? At the point where you're at about 27, when it becomes saturated with maximum sensory richness, where the human information channel is at its maximum in terms of the experience being real in the sense of sensorially rich. That is also the place at which it becomes completely unreal in terms of its gripping power. It disappears as a thing. Okay, it has no gripping power whatsoever, and therefore does not seem to be a thing anymore. There is simply an activity of consciousness that is flowing, and the sense that it is a physical body, a physical leg, etc., etc., vanishes. So what happens is you've got 2 sequences. The sequence of reality, in the sense of richness, is getting bigger and bigger. 1, 3, 9, 27. The sequence of reality in terms of how long you can fixate anything is getting smaller and smaller. 1, 1/3, 1/9, 1/27. So you have a paradoxical experience. In a sense, it's getting more and more real, and in another sense, it's getting less and less real.
Cartoon.
Huh?
It's like cartoons, it's in a very slow motion, and every picture has to be very real, but it's no longer coming.
Well, broadly, that's maybe a metaphor, but I think that this is a little more appropriate of a metaphor. So what we would say then is that you were so involved in the act of walking that you're no longer walking. You've escaped into walking. Okay? Now, that is a way when every mystic of the world will talk about a rich nothingness. It seems paradoxical. How can something be rich and yet empty at the same time? What I've just given you is one way to think about how that could happen.
Let's explain a little bit more about the feeling. I mean, what is exactly feeling nothing?
Well, you could say that it's very satisfying. But it's also transparent and empty at the same time.
But it's only in your legs or all your...
Well, this particular example I'm giving you is, I said, okay, let's say that you are only going to make walking your lifelong practice of meditation. So then how would you have an experience of liberation in the act of walking? So this is a way of thinking about what a complete experience of walking is. Now let's take something more complicated. You decide I'm going to sit for an hour, or I'm going to sit for 90 minutes, or I'm going to sit for 2 hours, or I'm going to sit for 4 hours. You decide I'm going to sit here. We call it strong determination sitting. Those of you that have done retreats in the Ubaken lineage, you've heard this term, adhitthana. It is a tradition. It's not something you have to do, but it's something that can be very interesting to learn from. what's going to happen? What's going to happen is that for a little while you're comfortable, and then you're not comfortable. Now, remember, in Buddhist practice, we never damage the body, okay? No one's ever going to encourage you to sit in a way that is going to leave any harm on your body, objectively. However, unless you have some very special condition, you can sit for an hour, 2 hours, maybe 4 hours without harming your body. But don't get me wrong, we don't want you to harm your body. But if you don't move at all after, let's say, 2 hours or so, you're going to start to get some very intense sensations. Will you only get intense body, will you only get intense touch? No, I think as the touch is getting more intense, you're going to start worrying about it, start judging it, start freaking out mentally and emotionally. So what does that mean? More and more uncomfortable touch, and at some point, there's sort of like in talk space, oh my God, this sucks, when's this going to end, this is Looney Tunes, okay. And then there's various images of getting up, images of what all the nice things that you'd have when you did get up, images of harm to the body, even though you know logically you're not. You get the images of being a cripple, images of amputation due to necrosis of the tissues, these sort of disconcerting, frightening pictures can come up, and that and then you start to notice that there's fear, and there's tear, and there's irritation. Okay. There it is. And then you can get into helplessness flavors, regressive, infantile, freak out, helplessness kinds of things. In other words, as touch gets more and more intense, feel, image, and talk, join in the concert, okay? That's the body-mind quartet that I was talking about. All the instruments start to play at once. Now, the average person would not be able to sit very long this way. They're going to get up. But unfortunately, the average person sometime in their life is going to have to face this. Something like this, right? Everybody's going to have to face it. Pain that you can't get away from, and you're mentally and emotionally freaking out. So a wise person vaccinates themselves against future suffering. A vaccination is a manageable dose of the disease that allows your body not to be killed by the actual disease. This is a metaphor. Okay, this is a metaphor. This is a comparison. Because you say, why would anybody do a strong determination sit? Why would anybody sit there for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, expose themselves to that when they don't have to? Well, because they're wise. They would rather do it under controlled circumstances now in a minor degree and not have to suffer horribly hour after hour, day after day, in an uncontrolled circumstance sometime in the future. So I say it's a vaccination against future suffering. If we went to a village in the New Guinea highlands where they had never seen Western medicine, and we tell everyone, hey, we got good news. We're going to wipe out cholera in your village. And they say, great, what do we have to do? Well, we're going to stick you with a needle, and then you're going to get sort of sick. In fact, it's going to be a little bit like having cholera. And what are they going to say? They say, well, wait a minute. I thought you said we were going to eliminate the cholera. You said you're not going to give me cholera? And it's like, well, yeah, sort of, but it's a manageable dose, and then that will allow you to have immunity in the future. Well, it might be a little difficult to sell this notion, okay? Well, it's difficult to sell people on the notion of, well, try sitting there for 2 hours without moving, okay? Why should I do that? Well, it's a manageable dose, it's controllable, and you'll, when something comes up in the future that's maybe a much bigger dose and lasts a much longer time, and it's not under these ideal circumstances of having meditators and silence and teachers and whatever, you'll be immune. Immune to pain? No. Immune to suffering because of pain. So, let's take this complicated situation. So you're sitting there, and let's say at some point it maxes out. Let us say, for simplicity's sake, that the maximum possible activation for feel, image, touch, feel, image, talk, we'll call it 10. You know that expression, it's a 10? That usually means it's like really good, okay? But we could also say it's a 10 in the, like, this is as bad as it gets. So let's say that after, I'd say it usually takes about 3 hours to get to a 10 in all four. Yeah, it's pretty bad, okay? That's pretty bad. By what mathematical function do we compute how much you are suffering at that point? I would claim that the answer, rather surprisingly, is it depends. Depends on what? Depends on your base level of concentration, sensory clarity, and equanimity. Well, can we do the math? Yes. I will give you an approximation of the math. Why I say approximation? Because a number of you have a science background. And you know that in science, often the actual mathematical description of a system is very messy. So we use linear approximations. We know it's not really like that, but it's close. So I feel duty-bound to speak with great precision. It's probably not exactly like this, but it's something like this. Touch is at pain, uncomfortable touch is at level 10. Uncomfortable emotion, feel, is at level 10. Troubling pictures is at level 10. and judgmental freak out chatter is at level 10. How do we calculate your suffering? Well, if you have no ability to untangle that, those strands will weave together into a web. They'll crisscross, and they'll reinforce each other, giving you the impression of 10 times 10 times 10 times 10. Now, what's 10 times 10? This isn't a trick question. What is it? 100. Now multiply by 10 again. What's that? Multiply by 10 again. 10,000. So if everything is maximally tangled, as it would be for the average person who has never meditated, that person says, I'm suffering at level 10,000, and it's unbearable, utterly unbearable. I would do anything to have this end, anything. Let's say, however, that you have very good sensory clarity. Then your experience will be exactly what is there. 10 plus 10 plus 10 plus 10. Now, what does that add up to? 40. A reduction from 10,000 to 40. Very roughly speaking, a 100-fold reduction, order of magnitude speaking. So that's very dramatic right there. 10,000 kilos is going to crush you. 40 kilos is a schlep, but it's manageable. That's the power of perfect sensory clarity. Schlep, okay? It means you have to carry it, right? It's a burden. Just through the sensory clarity. But now let's look at the concentration piece. Suppose your concentration is good enough that you can focus on just one so intently that that there's just that. Now that's, I always tell you that's not the goal, but as your concentration grows, it actually becomes possible to do that. Then at any given instant, the maximum weight you have to carry is 10 kilos. So that's a 1,000-fold reduction without changing the sensory experience at all. But it's still 10, and 10 is maximum. Can we do any better? Yeah. You discover that actually that 10 is really something more like 2 times 5. 2 actual units of pain multiplied by 5 units of resistance. So you bring equanimity and you get rid of the multiplying factor of the 5. Now you're dealing with 2, okay? So you went from 10,000 to 2 in the most extreme case. And what is that 2? As your awareness, as you have a complete experience second by second of that 2, it breaks up into a sequence of little vibrations, okay? And it becomes a kind of massage of energy that has the taste of purification. As though it is massaging the substance of your soul, as though it is working out the lumps in the dough of your nephesh. Okay? You know, when, if you have pizza dough, and it's got lumps, and you stretch and squeeze and stretch and squeeze, and as a result of that, the lumps break up. So when the equanimity is perfect, the clarity is perfect, and the concentration is perfect, what's left of the touch, feel, image, talk is this sort of flow of energy that seems like it's cleaning you out, massaging you, purifying your consciousness. I have personally met people that have sat not 9 hours, 9 days without getting up. You mean, can they still walk? Yes. You can read about these people. They're called the Marathon Monks of Mount Hiei. Mount Hiei is a mountain in Japan where the monks take a 12-year vow they will stay on the mountain for 12 years without leaving. During that 12 years, on two occasions, they do 9-day sits. That's 9 days straight without moving, without getting up. No drinking and no eating. You don't even think it's possible, right? It sounds like, wait, come on, no one can do that. But it's done right in the full view of everyone. It's not like, hey, I heard in the cave there's somebody doing that, okay? It's where all their followers are around, the Japanese press is there, okay? It's a public event. There's no doubt that guy sat there 9 days without moving. So I've had the privilege to eat rice with such people and to talk to them. What was it like? What he said was, the first 2 days were pretty rough. No, first 2 days were pretty rough. But after that, not so bad, actually. Now, this may seem like way out there, okay? It's like you're not eating, you're not drinking, you're not sleeping for, you know, like day after day after day. It's like way out there. But it's not so way out there. When my father died of lung cancer, he went for a week without eating, sleeping, and in fainting levels of pain. It could happen to anyone. These kinds of physical extremities are quite available to all of us. Okay? That's the extreme case. I'm not saying you have to do that to get enlightenment. But my dad had all the painkillers, and at some point they didn't work anymore. Okay, then hopefully, and in fact usually, the person will spontaneously fall into a state of equanimity and not suffer, hopefully. Until that happens, it can be pretty gnarly, okay? And besides, it's better to be able to live your whole life that way, because it's not just for the big things, it's also for the little daily annoyances that we do this practice.
It's quite a pessimistic way of
life. Say what?
It's quite a pessimistic way of life.
No, that's only part of the picture. I'm just giving you part of it. Remember I said that that the test for your skills for dealing with discomfort, how you test that is that it has increased your ability to appreciate pleasure. Okay? That's number one. And number two, you may not have to face big things that often, but we have to face little things all the time. And the same skills that work for the big things work for the little things in daily life. And it's the little things that add up that lead you in just 5 short years from passionate love to acrimonious divorce. Okay? That's minor irritations that were not skillfully experienced. So it's not just for the big things, it's for the little things also. And it's not just for dealing with discomforts, it's also to elevate fulfillment. But I just told this story because it's dramatic and interesting, okay? But I don't want to give the impression that that's the only reason we do this practice. But some of you are going to be trying some longer sits. And so this gives you an idea of sort of some of the possibilities, some of the things that you can explore. Now, there is a a central paradox on the meditative path. And there's no way around this paradox. It's something that just is. It's not something that you can think your way around. It's just something you come to experience directly. I would say it's the heart of the contemplative endeavor, the heart of the meditative endeavor, or the mystical path. At the core of it is the following. We touch a kind of nothingness. I'm describing a process whereby the somethingness dissolves back into a rich nothingness. We touch a kind of nothingness that fulfills us, which is very paradoxical. Although I've tried to give you a little hint of how that why the nothing can also be a richness. Okay? I've tried to give you an analogy. So something that is empty, shunyata we call it, or zero, or ayin. All the mystics of the world talk about God as a kind of special nothingness. It's universal. In Christianity, they talk about nihil per excellentiam. That means nothing par excellence, as opposed to nihil privativum, which is nothing in the sense of lack. Those are completely different nothings. One is the nihil of nihilism. The other is the nihil of the mystic. One is a devastating nothing. The other is a deeply fulfilling nothing. And it's strange. It's counterintuitive. It goes against our normal ways of thinking. Why would this special, how can a nothing be rich and fulfilling? But it just is. So there's two parts to the central paradox of world mysticism, because it's the same all over the world. Judaism, Islam, Buddhism. One part of the paradox is that it's a nothing that fulfills us. The other part of the paradox is that it is completely impersonal. It's not good. Not bad, it's not personal, and yet by touching it, our personalities improve. By touching that which has no heart, we become more heartful. By touching that that is not good or evil, we become more and more good and less evil. It's quite paradoxical. It's like muscles. How do you develop quality muscles? Well, actually, when you exercise muscles, you destroy muscles. Exercise breaks down muscle tissue. Okay? However, it is in the nature of nature that those muscles grow back better. The dissolution experiences that happen to us in various ways as we meditate, they break down the old self. And it is in the nature of nature that if you dissolve through concentration, clarity, and equanimity, if you take that path to nothing, it is in the nature of nature that the self will reappear from that nothing in a more loving and better form. So it's that's the process of dissolution and then reformation. Dissolution and reformation. Deconstruction, reconstruction. Deconstruction, reconstruction. That's the sort of central theme of what this is about. So now you know there are a lot of different ways to go about this endeavor, a lot of different styles of doing mindfulness practice, but they all share these themes in common. And I think that it's time to for the B2 of this talk.